actually the last night of lecture here for speculative bubbles. And the Mises Institute, we 250 people, 240 students, roughly 10 faculty, the biggest crowd we've ever had at Mises U, and it's really been quite something thus far this week. So anyway, if you've never been to Auburn, if you've never been to the Institute, I know when I used to come as a donor, it was served to charge my battery and get me very excited about Austrian economics. And so I urge you to come down if you ever can. If you can break away for a week in the summer, sit through. We had 26 paid observers this year, and it's really good experience. So anyway, give that some thought. But we've had a heck of a week, and Wednesday night is kind of a down night, thankfully. Normally we would have lectures going on right now, but and then a short dinner hour, and then there's a lecture after, and really it goes from 9 in the morning till really into the night. The talks go till 8 o'clock in the evening, and then the conversations, as you can imagine, stretch on fairly late into the evening here, either on the grounds or in around town, wherever people may end up. But anyway, I wanted to, first of all, there was a question about the Principles of Economics course that Grayson has put up, and the question was, well, he had Bob taught a course on ABCT earlier, so a principles course seems to be backing up a little bit. But what we're after here may not probably be something that you guys are going to be terribly interested in, but hopefully you have friends, neighbors who have kids, who have grandkids, who are very interested in having these kids learn economics from a great new book, a brand new book that Bob has completed. And we are at the stage of editing and printing and all that jazz. And it should be online by September 7th date. Of course, the ink and paper version soon after. And but this is really geared for junior high and high school students, probably more high school than junior high, but believe me, there's probably folks in the Obama administration that could benefit if they were so inclined to read through the book. But probably a little basic for you guys, based on your knowledge, certainly, but please let, if you can send a link to this class to homeschoolers out there or other people, parents out there who'd like their kids to get a good education. Bob is a fabulous instructor. He's improved that again here at Mises U this week, and Grayson can certainly vouch for how good he is on the small screen. And I know a few of you are taking him, and taking all our courses for that matter. But Bob's a real pro at this, and has written, like I say, a very wonderful book. So, not geared for you guys, but I think for young people out there, they would really get a lot out of this course, so we're hoping it'll be very successful. And even homeschoolers who don't want their kids to take it, maybe the homeschooler, the person doing the schooling, should probably take this course and bone up on economics so that they can teach it. So that's what Principles of Economics is all about. Very exciting piece of news that we just learned today, Dr. Gary North was here and gave a fabulous talk on Murray Rothbard. And we've talked to Gary North, and he is going to be teaching a course on American history, Rothbardian version of American history, starting in January. So, and if any of you have never heard Dr. Gary North speak, he is extraordinary, and he has he's written 50 books. He is a prolific writer, thinker, and just an extraordinary speaker. So keep that in the back of your mind for January, especially if you're history buffs, economics buffs, Rothbard buffs. You know, Gary North is going to be just fabulous come January. So we've got a pretty much a full slate in the fall with Bob Murphy. Tom Woods has a class, and we have a couple others that escape me at the moment. But and I know Bob would like to do a course on anarchy, a little short. We're not supposed to use the A word. Maybe private law enforcement, I think they're calling it. Who knows? But I think Bob wants to do a little four-week course on that we're talking about. So if you like this format, if you like these classes, we've got some very, very, very interesting stuff coming up. So we are always, and we're open to suggestion, by the way. We get ideas, and in the case of Tom DiLorenzo's course on the road to serfdom, that idea was hatched within days after Glenn Beck featured that book on his show. So we respond very quickly if we think there's a market. And so if you have ideas, let us know. By the way, Grayson has, again, if I neglect to say anything at the end of the night, I can't emphasize enough how amazingly fortunate the Mises Institute is to have been able to get the services of Grayson Laburne. He is quite a bit. You know him as kind of the teacher's assistant during this process, or the go-to troubleshooter guy while we're online, but he's been much more than that, and the Mises Academy would not be happening the way it's happening without his help and enthusiasm and hard work. And so I just want to again thank him profusely, and please, if you've enjoyed this format, he sure has a lot to do with it. So anyway, Grayson's done a wonderful job. I do want to tonight is a somewhat of a sort of an open-ended thing. We've come a long way. We've talked about a lot of different speculative bubbles, and you know, John Law obviously, and the South Sea bubble, and all the way up to Vegas and Japan in between, and the Roaring Twenties, etc. And so, I mean, the bulk of tonight is really to talk about, I think, probably what I would consider a couple of things that I think are probably current bubbles, but I'm open to suggestion, and I'm going to hopefully allocate the time that way. So you know, if you guys have ideas, don't hold back. This is it. This is our last night, where I will be on your tiny little screen or big screen, to the extent that you do that. I can't. That's a little hard for me to imagine. But if you do that, then that's fine, obviously. But this is our last night together, and then I will put together a final, and for those who choose to take the final, that's great. And if you don't, that's great too. Hopefully you've enjoyed the course, and it's been a fun experience for me, and to revisit a lot of this, and has really made me think about doing more work in this area, and so it's been inspirational in that regard. But just to backtrack just a tiny bit, I just want to mention something, and this was not in the assigned reading. We probably should have put it in there, but I do have the final chapter of the what was my thesis, what is now called speculative bubbles, early speculative bubbles, and increases in supply of money. The last chapter is, as most last chapters of any thesis are going to be, is really a summation of what you've said during the rest of the book, but I do mention something in here that I, at least in a way that I didn't in the other part of the book, and I don't know if Grayson can get it up on the screen or not. It doesn't matter if he doesn't, but this is on page 111, and obviously the book is online. You can pull it up on the Mises site, but on page 111, I cite Gottfried Herbler, who wrote a book, Money in the Business Cycle, great Austrian economist. And he mentions five things, interventions on the part of government to increase the supply of money, or a monetary interventions that government can make. And letter A, the first one is an increase in of gold and legal tender money. Is the first one he cites, and then B, an increase in banknotes, C, an increase of bank deposits and bank credits, D, an increase in circulation of checks, bills, and other means of payments which are regularly or occasionally substituted for ordinary money, and then E, an increase of the velocity of circulation of one or all of these means of payments. So these are four forms that this monetary intervention can take. And if we go back and look at the episodes that were mentioned, at least in the book, in the case of Tulipmania, was engendered with a huge, massive influx of specie in Amsterdam, so that would comport with Herbler's A above, the increase in specie. In the case of Mississippi Bubble, that was driven by John Law's paper, and that would be B and D above, an increase in banknotes and an increase in the circulation of checks, bills, and other means of payment. And in case of the South Sea Bubble, it was C and E, an increase in bank deposits and bank credits, and an increase in the velocity of circulation of one or all of these means of payments. So it's interesting that these three episodes would fall so neatly into Herbler's formula there. So, but that's the only backtracking from that chapter. If you ever wanted to take a look at that in the book, again, like any thesis, you know, when you write a thesis, you tell them what you're going to tell them, and then you tell them, and then you tell them what you told them, and of course, obviously, that's the way I kind of wrote this thing. So, The last chapter is really just a summary of what we've gone over in other talks. So tonight I want to talk a little bit about. I know that the title of the kind of this lecture was current bubbles. Chinese bricks and government paper, something to that degree. And I know at one time I had the Jim Chanos video up. I think that I'm not sure it's up now, but I think we had posted it at one time, where Jim Chanos, who's a famous short seller, of course, Chanos famously shorted Enron from 80 bucks a share to zero or whatever it was. I mean, he's a terribly successful guy, very smart guy, and it's his view that the property market in China is an enormous bubble that will pop very soon. It's interesting. We have some people here from China. And in fact, one is a real estate developer who's here at Mises University this week. And we've got a growing group of Misesians that have something happening over there in China. It's called, they're called iPencil. I asked through a translator, asked the property developer if he thought it was a bubble in China, that, it looked a little overheated and so on and so forth. And he came back and said, no, the property market has much further to go because of population moving in and, the usual rationalizations that are given. So it's for those who are developing property in China. I don't think they necessarily believe that it's a bubble, but that's the case with most bubbles. People operating within the bubble don't believe that they're in a bubble. Bubbles are hard to detect from the inside, much easier to detect from the outside. I know that I believe it. I forgot who sent the video of the vacant malls in China. I know there's been video posted on the Mises website of entire cities in China that have been built and nobody lives there. But property buyers have scooped up these properties with the belief that real estate never goes down in China. And so it's very interesting that Chinese government, of course, has pegged their currency to pegged the yuan or renminbi, if you will, to United States dollar in order to do that because of the trade imbalance. Of course, they've had to print lots of money to essentially keep that peg in place, that money is sloshing into real estate, I think there's every bit of possibility of a tremendous crash in the Chinese property market. The Chinese government has tried to manage it downward by decree. That doesn't work. We learned that in the John Law episode, where he tried to manage the shares of Mississippi Company down by decree, if you remember. So I don't think it'll necessarily work in China. And the point that Jim Chanos makes, I think he's taken a jab at Jim Rogers here, because Jim Rogers is very much a China bull, but Chanos makes the point that there's guys out there who believe in the free market, but for whatever reason, they believe the 12 guys in the that control all the government policy in China, that they can somehow manage the real estate market and keep it from being overheated and keeping it from being a bubble. And I think he's got a good point there. I don't think that these 12 guys or 24 guys or however many there are in the the Chinese bureaucracy there to manage that. Obviously, they're building real estate projects that have no economic use. Average people can't afford them, and speculators are scooping them up, but they can't find renters, and thus they're vacant. You got vacant cities, you got vacant buildings, you got vacant malls, and the Chinese property market would appear to be a bubble. I think the bubble that I'd like to talk most, at least that I'm going to talk about, and then I'm going to throw it open to you guys, is the muni bond bubble here in the United States. A number of people own muni bonds, and it's generally fairly well-to-do people or retired people, and they believe muni bonds are, a safe investment that is risk-free, more or less like real estate has been considered to be risk-free. They could never go down in value. One of the pieces that I put on for reading material, I'm not going to go through all that I put on there, but the City Journal article by Nicole Gelinas, I think, is pretty well done in this regard. She talks about Moody's, she talks about S&P, and of course we remember Moody's and S&P that blessed the collateralized debt obligations of mortgage-backed securities in the recent crash. They had called those AAA, and of course they are calling muni bonds essentially bulletproof. And so, she had the quote from Moody's: "We do not expect the states will default on general obligation debt, even under the most stressed economic conditions." Says, "We expect very few defaults in this sector given the tools that local governments have at their disposal," according to S&P. John Miller at Nuveen says, "State and local governments have strong incentives to maintain access to credit markets. Analysts also think the lending to state and local governments isn't risky, because they, unlike private firms, have a captive source of endless funds. State and local governments, by contrast, can always tax their residents and businesses to pay the bills, even as they gut services." So the idea here is that your normal business has to attract customers and appeal to their good sense and value with price and service and innovation, and state and local governments don't have to do that. They can essentially take people's money at the point of a gun, if you will. And there's something to that, of course, but state and local governments are finding it increasingly difficult to maintain the amount of revenue that they have in the past. They lived in a boom land, just like the rest of the economy did. As real estate markets boomed all over the country, city halls around the country began to tax real estate transfers. They charged more for sewer and water hookups. They expanded their staff. State and governments bubbled up as much as the rest of the economy did. Unfortunately, they created budgets that were unsustainable, but yet investors believe that they can continue to pay their debt. And she goes on in this piece to say state governments can't legally declare bankruptcy to escape debt. City governments can. City governments can, if they're allowed to by state statute, they can't in all states, but they can file what's known as a Chapter 9 in the bankruptcy court. States do not have anywhere in the bankruptcy code to cover this. And supposedly this is a positive. Supposedly, just because you can't file bankruptcy, obviously means that you will always continue to make your payments. Well, you can't make your payments. If you can't make your payments, it doesn't matter if there's a bankruptcy statute or not. I mean, they're just going to default on the debt. And so this idea that you would need a legal apparatus for states to file bankruptcy, I think that if states go broke, then you know there'll be another chapter written in the bankruptcy code that facilitates that. Now I know I have at least one lawyer, I believe, online here, and he may want to weigh in on that. But I don't think it's a good argument to say, well, states are always going to pay their debt because they can't go bankrupt because it's not legally possible for them to go bankrupt. I don't think that's a terribly good argument at all. We saw in the case of the debts of the government of France and England, et cetera, when they couldn't pay their debts, they repudiated the debts. They try to inflate their way out of it, of course, and the various schemes that we've talked about. States, unfortunately, do not have the ability to inflate their debt away. They're either going to have to somehow get it refinanced, or they're going to have to default. The state of New York, state of Nevada, do not have central banks where they can print money and pay their debts. So, and it's a similar case to Greece, I guess, in the sense that Greece owes a bunch of people money. Greece does not have a central bank, and thus they have to undergo these austerity programs to live within the budget. But that's tougher and tougher to do. Once people get used to the welfare mentality, government services, quote, this idea that that you can take that away, I think is something very hard for these governments to impose upon people. You get civil unrest, et cetera, et cetera. But anyway, the author of the City Journal article goes on to talk about New York State currently owes $3.3 billion general obligation bonds because these bonds require voter approval, yet the state has racked up $59.3 billion in total debt, often by setting up special trusts legally separate from the state government that issues the bonds on their own. So essentially they undergo some financial engineering that to escape the voters if they need the voters' approval to float this kind of debt. And governments all over the country are doing that. She writes that New York, California, and the borrowers that they are in turn oversee, like the MTA, are too big to fail. And back in 75, New York City stood on the brink of default. Washington helped Albany bail it out. So I think ultimately probably what you're looking for is, again, a Federal Reserve and a federal government coming to the rescue of these state governments. Of course, the federal government of the United States, not like they have a bunch of money laying around. They've got to print it up for this purpose. And again, that creates more more problems for them. So, but when you look at municipal debt, there have been very few defaults. She makes the case that in the Great Depression, municipal bond investors lost a tiny 0.5% point of their money. Between 1970 and 2000, according to Moody's, there were 376,000 cases when rated municipal bond insurers could have defaulted. Only 18 actually did, compared to 819 corporate defaults out of 61,000 possible. Between 70 and 2000, no investor took a loss on a city, on a state, or a city general obligation debt. So, general obligation debt being that it's not the debt is not for a specific project like a sewer system or something like that. This is just a general obligation of the of the city or the state of its ongoing revenues. Even when Orange County, which declared bank insolvency in 1994 to protect its pension assets from seizure, this is during this Robert Citron situation, who bet on all the derivatives and lost, they were able to pay every dime. So the view is that the muni bond market is very safe if that can happen to Orange County and nothing happened. But as the author points out, if this all sounds familiar, before 2006, conventional wisdom held that if you wanted a risk-free investment, couldn't do any better than buying mortgage-backed securities, which is true. Even if people couldn't make their payment, real estate would always go up in value, and if real estate could go up in value, people could refinance their homes, or they could always sell their homes, and the mortgage-backed securities would always be paid, and so they were essentially a risk-free investment. We have found out that that wasn't the case, and even when they did the financial engineering, where they cut these they aggregated these collateralized debt obligations secured by real estate, when they aggregated them and sliced and diced them into various tranches and called part of a AAA, those that would take the last loss as opposed to tranches that would take the first loss, which might have been rated something different. There were losses throughout all of the tranches because real estate can indeed go down, and cities and states can indeed go bust. So she makes the great point that I already mentioned: between 2000 and 2008, state tax revenues, buoyed by housing and financial industries, outpaced inflation by 15%, according to the census. Local tax collections mushroomed too, but instead of using this money to reduce their debt, state and local governments actually spent it on public education costs, expanding Medicaid for the poor, working class residents. The biggest partners in this this ramp up of state government, California, Illinois, New Jersey, New York, also piled on public sector labor costs. Of course, at the time when the states and cities appeared to be flush, most of that workforce is now unionized, and the unions, there's no easier target for a union than to be negotiating with City Hall, because City Hall is not negotiating with their own money. They're negotiating on behalf of the taxpayers, and we know what City Hall thinks of the taxpayer, or the state capitol, what they think about the taxpayer. the union wants something, they give the union what they want, and they ramp up these contracts, they ramp up extraordinarily lucrative pension, generous pensions, health benefits, the ability of workers to retire in their 50s, so to not only have one cop on the beat, you're paying for at least two and maybe three or four cops, the other three being retired, and you have the one on the, you have one on the job. So you have these states and local governments that have this incredible obligations that, again, now that we have a bust, they're not going to have the revenue to pay, but investors in these bonds just don't recognize that yet. She makes the point, even during the boom, money fell short. By 2008, state and local debt rose to $2.2 trillion, 49% higher after inflation than in 2000. Add in health and pension benefits for government workers, and you're adding up a staggering $3.2 trillion. And again, this is on the state and local. States alone have already borrowed another $15 billion for operating costs over the last 2 years. And of course, now we have this Build America bonds, the states borrow. It's not tax-free bonds, but for these infrastructure programs that is part of the stimulus. So they're able to access that. With that, 2010 may be a record year for municipal debt issuance and a lost year for fixing state and local budgets. She writes, the average state owes 2.1% of its citizens' annual personal income. Compare that to California, which owes 4.4% of its citizens' average annual personal income, New York 5.4%, New Jersey 6.7%. And if any of you have driven on the roads in New Jersey or New York, you will note a very crumbling infrastructure, at least from my take of it. So I think what happens is you have cities and states, infrastructure deteriorates and probably protection and law enforcement deteriorates because schools deteriorate so that they can pay pension obligations that they are legally contracted to pay. So it's that is the problem that's out there. She writes a little bit about Viejo, California. I assume the L's are silent. Who knows? 30 miles north of San Francisco. They did file Chapter 9. And of course, she cites city workers could retire in their 50s with fat pensions. I know they have four unions that they were negotiating with. They were able to make a deal with three. And they're still fighting with one of the unions. Their major bondholder is the Union Bank of California, is who holds most of these bonds. And so, and they are, as promised in its exit plan, to defer payments on its bonds for 3 years, saving up cash and investing in infrastructure before paying lenders in full. So if you're a holder of these bonds, you're on hold for 3 years while they take care of infrastructure needs. Gee, I wonder what will happen in 3 years. My guess is it gets delayed another 3 years and so on and so forth. But are investors paying attention to this? No. They've treated the Viejo bankruptcy as a minor annoyance, and and just don't don't pay any attention to it. So these cities and states are going to have considerable problems. The next on the same subject, I'm going to be talking from the June 25th edition of the Grants Interest Rate Observer. Any of you who know anything about grants will know that there's a reason that I am not posting this, and that is because Jim Grant would pretty much do everything just short of hunting me down and shooting me. He's that crazy about copyright. He has not embraced the Mises Institute open source view of IP. So anyway, he's very protective of his content, but that doesn't keep me from talking about a piece that he wrote. This is a long piece and a very interesting piece, and has a lot of great information in it on the municipal market that came out on the June 25th edition, in an article called "Concerning the American Repudiation Gene." He always has very interesting titles, and that's one of them. So, but he talks about municipality overburdened with $2.2 billion in unfunded pension liabilities, and he's talking about San Diego, and $1.3 billion in unfunded healthcare liabilities. So San Diego's talking about Chapter 9 as well. He cites four other American cities who are talking about going into Chapter 9. Harrisburg, Detroit, Los Angeles, and Miami have dropped a hint that they may go Chapter 9 in the near future. But again, as he says, the so low are the yields, so complacent are investors, so persistent are fiscal deficits, so heavy is the weight of the post-retirement employee benefits, and so ill-equipped are mutual funds to deal with anything resembling a shareholder's run that we are prepared to take the analytical lead. The leap he's talking about is in terms of the muni market is that Grants is extremely bearish on this particular investment class. He makes reference to AAA rated CDO tranches, collateralized debt tranches that investors piled into at very, very low rates. Municipal bond buyers have retained their storied imperturbability. He said, he quotes The Economist, by 2018, Illinois will be paying $14 billion a year in post-retirement pension and health benefits, equal to more than a third of the state's revenue, compared with $6.5 billion now. Because several state constitutions, including those in Illinois and New York, make state pension senior to bond debt, yet bondholders seem not to worry. Possibly they reason federal tax rates are probably going up, and Chapter 9 is a costly and time-consuming procedure. So, he's talking about investors are really turning a blind eye. And if we look at who's invested in, and he gets to this later in his piece, households and commercial banks in 2010 are really the largest holders of municipal debt. Households by a long shot, followed by commercial banks, and then it goes down to mutual funds, money market funds, etc. It's individual households that have these. And I think it's you know your typical little old lady who has a fairly unsophisticated broker who says, gee, this stuff is rated AAA, you can't get hurt in this, and you can sleep at night, and it's tax-free. And so that's why people are running this sort of investment. So he goes on to talk about, besides all the bullish argument continues, not even the Great Depression stopped the overwhelming majority of cities and states from discharging their obligations. In modern times, the defaults of New York City in 1975, Cleveland in 1978, Saco, Maine in 1979, the Washington Public Power Supply System Project numbers 4 and 5, I think that was called WHOOPS, in 1983, Orange County, California in 1994, were notable mainly for their novelty. Of Chapter 9 bankruptcies, there have been 554 since the 1930s, the 1984 filing of Sanitary and Improvement District number 3 of Sarpy County, Nebraska, being a diversely obscure example. Orange County is the notorious one. Of course, we mentioned that before with Robert Citron, who tanked them with his derivatives bet. And these blemishes are or have been the exception. A Friday report by Moody's Investors entitled U.S. Municipal Bonds, Defaults and Recoveries shows that while defaults in the market as a whole are rare, those in the general obligation department of the market in which securities are supported by the full taxing power of the issuing government are virtually non-existent. So to this point, nobody's lost any money at this. And if nobody's lost any money at this, the point of view is that nobody ever will. You know, there have been just 54 defaults in the 39 years in the muni market. Moody's finds a default being defined as a missed or delayed interest payment, a bankruptcy filing, or a distressed exchange, and even for CAA and C-rated munis, you know, you did have 11.6% of them default, but there were no defaults in the AAA category. So, and A-rated bonds, just a trivial 3 basis points. So, when you compare it to corporate bonds, there's just been very, very few defaults. So the credit profile of the U.S. state and local government sectors is very strong, according to Moody's. The U.S. state and local governments remain increasingly resilient despite growing pressures, and we fully expect that under our baseline scenario for the macro economy, again, this is Moody's talking, the vast majority of municipal governments will make timely debt service payments consistent with the remarkably low default experience seen in the sector over the last 60 years. Again, this means that past performance is a prologue to future performance. Moody's concede that most of these governments are and will remain pressured. But severe credit stress will be selective and idiosyncratic. Moody's allows, in our opinion, it is extremely unlikely that there will be a cultural shift in the market towards increasing use of Chapter 9 bankruptcy or a wholesale erosion of investor appetite. The states are inherently resilient from credit perspective, and for a variety of reasons, we do not expect that states will default on general obligation debt, even under the most stressed economic conditions. So, so there's the bullish case for muni bonds. I mean, if you would read that, you would say, You know, Moody's and S&P say they're bulletproof. If you look at past performance, they have 60 years where nobody's gone default. So, this must be the safest place to put your money that there is. And certainly people are doing that. But the bearish case is interesting. The worst recession since the 1930s. The Washington-based Center for Budget and Policy Priorities reports, quote, has caused the steepest decline in state revenues on record. As a result, even after making very deep spending cuts over the last 2 years, states continue to face large budget gaps. At least 46 states face or have faced shortfalls for the upcoming fiscal year. These come on top of large shortfalls that 48 states faced in current budgets. That was for 2010. States will continue to struggle to find the revenue needed to support the critical public services for a number of years, threatening hundreds of thousands of jobs. And were it not for the massive subsidies from Washington, the state's P&Ls would be printed in an even deeper shade of red. The legislative Christmas tree called the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act 2009 earmarked $135 billion to the states, or between 30-40% of their shortfall. Federal assistance will end before state budget gaps have abated. So the only reason that these states continue to keep on keeping on, in many cases, is that through the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009, they've been able to get help with 30-40% of their budgets. If that were not the case, then they would be even deeper in the red than they already are, and be in worse shape. Illinois has a $13 billion budget deficit, and intractable post-retirement benefits funding shortfall among them. It used to be when you bought municipal bonds, and I know we have people who probably are in this business who sell this product that may be online with us tonight. Used to be fully 57% of new issuance came wrapped in an insurance policy as recently as 2005. In other words, if you bought a municipal bond, you weren't just dependent on the credit viability of the county of San Diego or county of Clark in Nevada or whatever it might be. You would have them insured. Well, with the downfall of MBIA and the collapse of AmBank, less than 10% of the new issuance is guaranteed today. So there are very few, 10% of municipal bonds that are guaranteed. And in fact, the one guy that we can most identify, with insurance, Warren Buffett, as Grants writes, has kept his distance from the muni bond insurance business. So if Warren Buffett does not think he can make a buck by writing insurance, insuring the creditworthiness of muni bonds, then that has to make you think that possibly there is more risk there than would meet the eye. Grants then goes into the CDS market, and if you want to remember the CDS market, remember that's the credit default swap market, and that is an instrument where, really, if you want to take the bearish side of the argument, you buy the credit for default swaps, you pay on it as if it was kind of like an insurance policy, and then the value of that as the credit deteriorates, the cost of that goes up, and that's how you make money in that market. And it's Bloomberg quotes CDS quotes on dozens of states and city of New York City, including such hard cases, this Grant's words. Illinois is 313 basis points, California 296 basis points, New York roughly 245 basis points, New Jersey 243. So it used to be that it was, before you had a CDS market, you really couldn't lay down a bet, you know, against the viability of individual state debt. Before the CDS market, you really couldn't bet against the housing market on a nationwide basis. Well, or you couldn't bet necessarily on the viability of foreign debt, Greek debt, Spanish debt, etc. CDS market has made that possible, and of course politicians have vilified those who've bet on the CDS market, especially in the case of those who have bought CDS in the case of Greece, profited from it, and really, you know, if you view markets as Austrians do, as providing information. Prices provide information, and the prices in the CDS market expose the weakness of these individual credits, and that's what prices CDS market does. And in the case of these states, you know, it has exposed that they're not in terribly good shape. New York, with its dysfunctional legislature, again in Grant's words, $9.2 billion budget deficit, business unfriendly tax regime, and inventive public policy ideas, e.g. a new proposal to allow the state municipalities to borrow nearly $6 billion from the state pension fund to facilitate their payments to the same pension fund. So the idea here in New York, they're very clever up there. The idea is that they need to shore up the pension fund and make payments on behalf of their employees to that fund. So their idea is, why don't we borrow from the pension fund and then turn around and make the contributions on behalf of state employees to that same pension fund. We've heard a lot of crazy stories during the last 8 weeks, and that I think ranks right up there in terms of attempted financial alchemy, if you will. So, you know, good luck with New York, and good luck with how the market views all that. Grants goes on, it says that they talk about the Treasury, or they talk about the muni market being kind of a sleepy market. Tax-exempt securities prices have tended to mosey in any market past its prologue until suddenly it isn't. And we've certainly found that out, right? That, you know, the housing market is great until it isn't. Stock prices are great until they're not. And that's the case here. In any market past its prologue until suddenly it isn't. I think that there is a real danger of a shift in thinking about the municipal market if we have a sizable bankruptcy. According to a gentleman from Brown Brothers. And so it would take just really one bankruptcy probably to create essentially a run for the exits in the muni bond market. And that is not, I mean, it's a fairly liquid market, but I don't think there's a whole lot of players in it. It would probably be pretty tough to get out that door. And again, rates are so low. The yields on The AAA-rated muni bonds right now are yielding 3.81%. The AAs are rated 5.4%. And back in 87, of course, they traded roughly at about 8% and have come steadily down in fits and starts. You know, you get a pop, you get a lot of people selling these bonds, you get rates up to 9-10%. You could very quickly be losing half your principal with rates not really going, you know, all that high. This gentleman from Brown Brothers, as they go on to quote him, "We've had so few defaults since the Great Depression that most buyers, even with negative press of late, view munis as having virtually a zero chance of default. Zero chance of default. This is the mindset of most owners, particularly older, wealthier people who tend to be disproportionate owners of munis. This is the way they think of them. Virtually no risk." You know, Grant goes on to, they say, listening to this gentleman, Mr. Klotz, "We believe, we think of the late great bull market in American residential real estate and the AAA-rated mortgage tranches that collateralized. In living memory, there had been no coast-to-coast bear market in houses, right? There'd never been a coast-to-coast bear market in houses. Ben Bernanke had famously said back in 05, 06, someone questioned the idea that housing might go down, and he shot down the premise of the question and said, you know, that's not possible. We've never had home prices go down in the history of the United States since the 1930s, and so that's really not possible. And that was the argument, of course, for real estate, and of course that's the argument now in the muni bond market. They go on to talk about, according to data compiled by Moody's, the ultimate recovery on bonds that defaulted between 1970 and 2009 averaged 67 cents on the dollar. Be that as it may, we are reasonably confident that for today's munis, as for yesterday's mortgage-backed security tranches, the downside looms larger than the upside. You know, as we know, and some of the collateralized debt obligations in housing ended up being worthless. Not all of them were, but some of them were worthless. Most of general obligation bonds of cities and states, they're not backed by any assets. It's just essentially securitizing the taxing ability of the individual government involved. So, if you had a city fail, if you have a state fail, I mean, you could virtually end up with nothing. But even short of that, even if the market finally decides to recognize the risk inherent in the muni bond market that obviously they're not seeing now. I mean, if a muni bond buyer is accepting a 20-year rate at 3.81%, you know, I just don't know anybody who would accept that kind of rate. Just based on a, you know, view of uncertainty in terms of inflation, but to make a 20-year bet and only get 3.81% interest is an extraordinary bet. That's a very clear crystal ball that I can't imagine anybody can possibly possess. And I think that, but if that rate would double, if it would triple, it would decimate obviously the principal amount, market principal amount of that particular bond. Obviously, if they hold the bond to maturity, then and they're able to pay them back at that time, or get them advanced, then or refinance, you might get your money back. But the market rate, market risk, on a mark-to-market basis is considerable. So, not the least of the troubles with the tax-exempt securities is that there are so many of them. Except for a brief decline in the mid-90s, the volume of the outstanding state and local government debt has grown at an average rate of 8.9% a year since 1945. For perspective, the federal government's debt over the same span has risen by an average rate of only 5.6%. As a percentage of GDP, today's $2.8 trillion of tax-exempt debt amounts to 19.4%. A new high and up from 14.6 in 2000. Now we've seen this in every, virtually every bubble we've looked at, as the price of any of these securities go up, more of them are created. Whether it was John Law or South Sea Bubble or stock issuance in Japan or in the 20s or whatever it might be. When the price of these securities go up, when there's tremendous confidence in the value of these securities, what they do is they create more of them. And in the case of municipal debt, to me that is shocking. I would have never, if you would have quizzed me out of the blue and said, has there been a higher increase in the amount of municipal and state debt created since 1945, or a higher issuance of federal government debt since 1945 vis-a-vis state and local, I would have picked federal easily. But that is an extraordinary statistic, especially in light of the federal debt and how much that's gone up. So, I mean, if that is not a scary statistic for anybody who has municipal bonds, I don't know what is. They go on to, in this piece, quote a gentleman in the Wall Street Journal, Steve Malanga, and who writes, "Much state and local debt now exists in independent authorities whose borrowings are not subject to voter approval. Some of these agencies have been operating recklessly," and then they cite a couple of these things. So, you know, again, they've tried to keep these away from. This is the point that was made by the author of the City Journal piece, that they try to keep some of this debt issuance away from the voter and away from the voter being able to vote on these things and ramp these things up. So, Grant goes on to write that we're going to speculate that the debtors and creditors of the 1870s had a moral compass not much different from that of their 21st century descendants. They defaulted on municipal debt. We walk away from mortgages. If we seem less willing to renounce a public debt, it might just be that the Federal Reserve, by its massive dollar printing, has pushed the temptation to do so into the future. The panic of 1873 had brought on a depression. Prices, taxes, tax receipts, and the value of assessed real estate declined because there was no Fed. Actually did have a depression or a deflation, but as Murray Rothbard has written, the two decades following the panic of 1873 were actually quite prosperous because the economy was able to heal and there was tremendous gains in productivity and employment and so on and so forth. So it's a little bit mischaracterized in this paragraph. It says, "But yet the contracted value of the debts remained the same. The encumbered cities, states, and counties struggled to meet fixed charges. Some decided not to pay or to pay on their own terms, among them the states of Alabama, Arkansas, Florida, Georgia, Louisiana, Michigan, Minnesota, Mississippi, Texas, or Tennessee, and Virginia." So The idea of states defaulting on their debt isn't exactly new. We haven't heard about it lately, but it certainly has happened in American history. And Grant speculates that the states might invoke what's known as force majeure, which is more or less a act of God, if you will. They might claim that the current recession, depression, lack of tax receipts rolling in is a more or less an act of God, and use that as a reason not to pay. So back in January of 1934, there were 2,000 American municipal borrowing units that were in default. '34, there was no less than $2 billion that was in arrears. The number of defaulting borrowers were growing at 100 a month. So there were various municipalities that were in the Depression that were defaulting on their debt. Grants makes the case that nor was 25% unemployment exactly a constructive force for municipal creditworthiness. And so the idea here is that, as unemployment goes up, the stress on local governments is going to be to provide more service, and their ability to tax is going to be is limited. Nowadays, in talking about who owns municipal debt, and he talks about today's AAA yields range from 2.7% to 3.8%. According to maturity, it's not much higher than the one in place 60 years ago. So yields are about the same, but the market would be otherwise unrecognizable. Way back then, households owned just 26% of the outstandings, while state and local governments themselves held 9.7%. Nowadays, commercial banks hold just 7.7%. State and local governments hardly hold any. Maybe they see the handwriting on the wall they write. Households have filled the breach, holding two-thirds, roughly evenly divided between direct investments and mutual funds. So the majority of people who own these municipal bonds are individual owners, and they own them either directly or through mutual funds. So, and tax-exempt mutual funds, they promise daily liquidity, and so they kind of resemble equity funds. But the mutual fund is comparatively illiquid. Grants points out, it would be hard to turn great blocks of infrequently traded tax exempts into cash if enough shareholders urgently came calling. And so if you did have a run for the exits in the municipal bond arena, you would just have huge gaps, I think, upward in rate, downward in price in that market. But what are people doing? Are they like any what I would call bubble? People are pouring money into this. They are clamoring to buy more and more muni bonds. Grants writes, from January to May, Vanguard's, and he's talking about the Vanguard Intermediate Term Tax Exempt Fund, from January to May, Vanguard's net assets climbed by $1.7 billion, or 6.2%. Industry-wide inflows rose by 5.3% through the first 4 months of 2010, following a 23% surge in 2009, one of the biggest such gains on record. Plainly, where we see risk, the majority of investors see safety and soundness. So, you know, I think the what we see in the muni bond market is this idea that you can't lose, and that the money is safe, and that's what people are piling into, and it would appear to be a bubble that's ready to pop, just like home buyers. Mortgages were being made to home buyers who couldn't service the interest on those loans, yet those loans were being packaged and sold on Wall Street and rated AAA and viewed as credit good instruments. We have bonds being created floated by governments who can't possibly service the interest in the long term. Likely will not be able to get them refinanced at some point, and eventually that that market, in my view, would be vulnerable to falling apart and cracking up. So that's one of my that's a couple of the bubble ideas that. That I had kind of going into the tonight. I get Barron's, of course, it's for those of you who get Barron's. Alan Abelson's column is generally at the top of the magazine, and he is talking about a gentleman named Peter Barrison, who works for the bank credit analyst, and this guy at the bank credit analyst is taking the view that that the gold market may be in a bubble. I think they're trying to kind of construe this idea that the gold's in the bubble because, number one, it has obviously risen from $250 an ounce back in 2000 or 2001 to 9 years later, it's $1,200 or whatever it's backed off to. But with the advent of ETFs, the ability to for people to throw money into the ETFs that are backed by gold, they believe that he believes, this gentleman, that there's a brewing speculative mania in gold, and that the ETFs, exchange-traded funds, over the last 3 years have tripled. They've tripled in the amount of gold that they're holding, and so the gold market is, in their view, ripe for a fall. And he sees early warning signals such as, number one, an increase in real interest rates, which he feels are bound to rise as the global economy continues to recover. Now, I don't know where he gets this continues to recover idea. I don't think there's any recovery going on at all. So I don't really understand the idea there. But I guess his point is that when real interest rates, and that is the nominal rates minus inflation, when those are low, you know, people obviously steer away then from interest rates and invest in other things such as gold. And if it flops around and there's actually an increase in the real amount of interest being paid, then they're going to tend to gravitate toward earning that interest. And that's what he views is coming, and thus that'll hurt the gold market. Number two, he sees a decline in inflation expectations. Disinflation, he notes, is gold's arch enemy, and he believes over the next few years deflation is the biggest risk. Deflation of what? You know, asset prices. Well, we've already had continue to have deflation, if you want to talk about price deflation of asset prices. Gold historically has done well during both inflations and deflations, but nevertheless, he sees deflation and that being bad for gold. He says evidence of the European sovereign debt crisis is fading. If and when that happens, the appeal of gold as a currency of last resort will diminish and prompt the market to price in more central bank tightening. That means people are going to go back to paper money. They're going to go back to the euro. But then in the next in his next point, he says there's a further increase in trade-weighted dollar index. He views the greenback as the best house in a bad neighborhood, and over time will strengthen against the euro and the yen, sparking a reassertion of the a negative trend between bullion and the trade-weighted dollar index. He sees a spike in speculative interest in gold, perhaps aping the wave of retail buying that marked the peak in the early 80s bull market in the metal. I don't see that. I mean, I would love to hear comments from you guys in terms of, for those of you who are interested in gold, and I'm not sure you all are, but you have asked questions during the course of our time together about gold and the possibility of a bubble in gold. And you know, yes, at Mises University, believe me, I have had lots and lots of discussion about gold this week, but it's primarily because I gave the lecture on money, number one. Number two, I gave a talk on, guess what, speculative bubbles last night, which was a story about Vegas, which you guys heard. You heard a longer version of. But most people who want to talk to me want to talk to me about money, and they want to talk about gold. But I think the average guy on the street is not trying to find his nearest gold shop. Now, I could be wrong. I mean, maybe you guys have all of a sudden have your friends starting to ask you about how to buy some gold. Maybe the last stripper who was on your lap was telling you to buy gold. That's a sure sign, by the way, that it's hit its peak. You know, who knows? I don't know what's going on out there, so I'd love your feedback from all the way from Tokyo to Europe and everywhere in between of what your friends and neighbors are talking about gold, to the extent you talk about it. Maybe if you don't care about it, nobody talks to you about it, but people talk to me about gold all the time. And he says, number six, a further increase in the cost of put and call options on gold compared to those is S&P 500. So increase in put and call options typically means that there's more volatility involved, the quote is, the higher upside that investors are assigning to gold is at odds with the fact that historically equities have trounced gold as an investment. Well, I don't think gold is an investment. I mean, I think that's the fallacy right there. I mean, I don't think gold. I think gold for most people is insurance. Gold is you put gold away, and you hope you die with it. If we ever have to pull it out of our little cubby holes or safe deposit boxes and trade it for goods and services, or to get across the border, or whatever the case may be, then things have degenerated, and we hope it doesn't get that bad. I mean, I suppose there's people who buy gold for, you know, they want to buy it at $1,000 and sell it to $1,200. But most people I know who buy physical gold just do it to have it as a, you know, help them sleep at night. Anybody who's studied enough economic history about or even recent economic history about Zimbabwe or Weimar Germany or the various hyperinflations. I know a few of you, I think, are taking Hunt Tooley's hyperinflation class. Having a few gold coins around, I think you would think is probably a mandatory thing just to live your life in some kind of peace. So this idea that you know, there's this growing speculative mania, as he puts it, in gold is again, it's hard for me to, when we look at I think when we look at the Minsky model that we did in the first week, I don't think some of the things are in place that would really lead me to believe that that gold is there. And the other thing is, when we compare something like gold to municipal bonds, I don't think there's this idea that you know, I don't think anybody's out there saying, well, you can't lose money at gold. I think there's plenty of people out there that go, gee, gold is risky. And in fact, you know, at least one stockbroker here in Auburn is quite alarmed, shall we say, at the amount of gold investments that I may have, and feels like that's real risky. Whereas, opposed, I think gold is not risky at all. But I think the typical investment view of it is that it's risky. I think to me, gold is an anti-investment. I mean, it's a form of money. It's always been money. It's people's money. And it's when you're too scared to do anything else, don't have any good ideas on stocks or bonds or anything else, I think what you do is you put a few coins in your away and let it go at that. I got a question about after what happened during the mortgage fiasco, do I think Moody's is at least a little more wary of giving out AAA ratings? You know, I haven't necessarily read anything that would indicate that they are, but I think that, and I think they got a pretty light touch during this 2,300 pages of financial regulation, fine reg. You know, I think they're certainly should be more careful. They should be more wary. But, you know, I think those biases are in there about, and I think being a contrarian and going against the conventional wisdom is very hard to do. And I think you probably, it's a risky career move if you're writing for Moody's and you say, gee, I think the state of Illinois is not rated, you know, whatever, because pretty soon, as soon as Moody's does that, Moody's gets a call from the governor's office of the state of Illinois or whatever state we're talking about, and they're going to have a fit about that, because it costs them more tax money to service the debt. And so I, Moody's may be a little more careful, but, you know, who knows? I think the other, you know, the other potential bubble is that maybe gets mentioned every once in a while is U.S. government debt. Boy, the idea that six-month money goes for 19, yields 19 basis points, something like that. 2 years is I think less than 100 basis points, and just pitifully low rates that again people have piled into for for safety purposes. Now, there are some people who believe that the whole idea that people are moving to something that's safe by definition means it's not a bubble. But I don't think that's, I don't think we can necessarily say that. I mean, there is credit available in all of these markets that we're talking about. I mean, you can buy muni bonds on credit if you want to. If you can buy, certainly there's a huge carry trade operation in buying U.S. government securities. The gold market, if we want to throw that into this batch, you know, you can buy gold on credit both in the futures market, and in fact, if you buy gold from Monex, you can buy on credit. I think you put 20% down, and I don't know what the interest rate is on it, but there are more and more people buying gold using credit. You know, there is the availability of the use of credit, which we've learned in the past is important to fuel these speculative manias. But those are, I think it's possible in the U.S. bond market and the muni bond market. I think, you know, when I think of all these bubbles, what sticks out to me is the idea that you just can't lose. And the prevailing wisdom is so strong that you just can't miss with these particular assets. So, another question, number one, in the Ascent of Money, Niall Ferguson mentions 1895 to 1900 Kaffir gold mine bubble. Are you familiar with this bubble? I'm sorry, I'm not. I'm not familiar with that bubble at all. Number two, I can understand how tulips can be considered high-order capital goods, considering they are traded mainly in the futures market at the time of tulipmania. I'm, however, wondering what happened to other prices in consumer goods furthest from consumption during the actual tulipmania. Where can I find this information? The information is hard to find around tulipmania in terms of price levels. I was able to find it when I did the work on the Mississippi bubble. But what I do, what I was able to find, as I mentioned last week, was the number of bankruptcies did, I believe, double or triple, whatever it was, in the wake of tulipmania. And interest rates were actually low. So you had low interest rates, you had a tremendous amount of money, and of course you had speculation in tulips. My guess is, and of course Amsterdam was really the absolute epicenter of commerce in Europe at that time. I would have to guess that consumer prices were higher. I don't know. I don't have a price index for you that I could refer you to. Certainly, if you find something, please send it to me. And if I find something, I'll send it to you because I'd be very interested in knowing that. And who knows, if I do some kind of update to what I've already written, maybe I would include that, because I think that'd be very compelling information as we found out during really all these bubbles, whether it was tulips or you know, Mississippi Company shares, South Sea Company shares, real estate went up at the same time. Typically, prices in the case of France went up, so you did have a huge inflation. But I don't have a pricing indices for you, so I apologize for not having that information. Let's see. Wouldn't gold do badly in a real deflation like the Great Depression? I know it did well in the 30s, but there was price control of 20 to 1 to the dollar. In 08, the price of gold collapsed until the Fed... warmed up the printing presses. I would have thought it was it's just an inflation hit. Any thoughts? Well, it did well. Yeah, it held up well in the 30s, and again, there was a you're right. I mean, it was a fixed rate, not actually a 20, not 20 to the dollar. They confiscated it at about 20 to the dollar, and then FDR took the gold and revalued it, I think, at what was it, $34 an ounce or something like that. And so once he took the gold and traded dollars for the gold, he took the gold into the treasury and then he revalued it, and that obviously helped his treasury. You can make a pretty darn good argument that there really wasn't an active gold market during most of the Depression, because most people didn't own any gold. But what's typically cited is that gold mining companies like Homestake, which doesn't exist anymore, did very well in price. And again, I think that they were able to make money because their costs went down, as the cost of labor went down, the cost of other inputs into mining went down. The point's made in 08, the price of gold collapsed until the Fed warmed up. We're talking about 2008. There may have been there was a dip in 08 when the rest of the markets crashed, and that's mainly driven by the fact that there was a scramble of liquidity that investment managers, hedge funds especially, had to sell whatever they could sell to maintain liquidity, and the most liquid market out there is the gold market. And so yeah, the price in 08 cratered along with the rest of financial assets, and again, it was for that very reason. When you get a crash and you're leveraged, you sell not what you want to, you sell what you can sell. And one thing that you can always sell is gold. But if you were a hedge fund loaded up with fairly illiquid securities, possibly CDOs or instruments like that, then to raise liquidity, you did it by selling whatever you could, and the gold. Gold went down with it, and of course the Fed hit the gas, expanded its balance sheet, and of course we know what's gold's done since then. I think that if we have another meltdown in stocks and financial assets, paper assets, gold will go right there with it, again, for just the exact same reason. Hedge fund managers, people that manage money, and I know there's a few that are part of this group, they will sell what they can sell to keep their boat afloat. And so I would expect the same kind of correction. I somewhat think gold's a little bit ahead of itself, but I just don't. I'm not very good at the prediction business, so I buy it and put it away, and occasionally pull it out when I do a money speech and use it as a prop. But other than that, don't look at it. So, how has the purchasing power of an ounce of gold held up over the last 150 years ago, or so? If I were to sell an ounce of gold for dollars, would I be able to buy a similar quantity and quality of goods that I could have bought 20, 50, 100, 150 years ago? how does that compare to today? Yeah, I mean, that's the thing about gold. I mean, there's this famous axiom that an ounce of gold, you've always been able to buy a good quality men's suit for an ounce of gold. So back when gold was $20, you could buy a nice men's suit. Now, at $1,200, you can buy, I would say, a pretty darn nice man's suit. So, and we're not talking about Joseph A. Banks or something like that. Obviously, it ebbs and flows, but I think over time, I think gold holds up fairly well. But there is some, you know, it gets undervalued, it gets overvalued. But again, I think there's a pretty good case at the rate it is now that it's not necessarily overvalued. Based on just what it'll buy compared to what it would buy historically. You could say that gold, the price of gold hasn't done anything. It's just the value of dollar has done nothing but decrease from whatever the calculation is. It's got to be over, say, I mean, if you divide 20 into 1,200, that's 1.6%. That would mean that the dollar has fallen roughly from back in that time when a 1 ounce of gold was a $20 gold piece. I mean, if you want to look at it that way, you know, as the value of the dollar fallen over 98%. Well, yeah, I think by most measures that. It's very easy to make that case that virtually with any and all goods, purchasing power of the dollar has fallen that much, and gold is held pretty steady. But certainly there's been ebbs and flows. I mean, gold was probably ahead of itself when it had $850 an ounce in 1980 or 79 or 80, whatever it was, and then certainly undervalued, I believe, at $250 an ounce back in 2000. But there has been a whole lot of money printed since the year 2000. And so, if anyone was going to compare the number of ounces of gold mined to the amount of dollars printed, I mean, it's just an extraordinarily low percentage. So, if one expects the U.S. dollar to crash, hyperinflation, does it make sense to buy the gold ETF GDLD? Since, after all, one would be paid in U.S. dollars and the price of U.S. dollar would move up or down erratically during hyperinflation, would it make more sense to buy the ETF in the renminbi, if possible, or another currency? One of the guys who's very responsible for me sitting in this seat and having this job is a guy named Bert Blumert. And Bert Blumert was the proprietor of Camino Coins, and was certainly my gold dealer, our gold dealer, while he was alive. Passed away over a year ago. And Bert's view was that if you're going to own gold, you need to have it and hold it and know where it's at. He was not a big fan of ETFs, probably primarily because, in his view, he didn't know whether they had the actual gold or not. Is it a fractional reserve system? Are they holding X amount of ounces and print an X number of shares of GLD, more GLD shares than they have actual gold. But also, when you wanted to get out of GLD, then you're into dollars, and that'll be the question. I mean, in a hyperinflation, are you going to trade them for dollars to trade with? I think you'll be able to make much better trades with the actual coinage. And if it gets to that point, then probably a good idea to have some tenths of an ounce and even smaller denomination than tenths. There's 20ths out there. Little island country called the Isle of Man has these little I think 20th of an ounce. So there's tiny little weights of gold out there, and I think those would be very handy. Obviously, silver is going to come in handy in that case too. But as far as the renminbi goes, if you want a renminbi account, there may be an ETF in it, but also you can buy a CD with a place called Everbank. Go to everbank.com. They virtually sell CDs that in all foreign currencies. You can't legally own renminbi if you're a United States citizen, but they do it through some sort of hedging futures account. So they've created the product. I've had some money in renminbi, but I don't currently. There was a time where I had a CD in Icelandic kroner. Boy, glad I got out of that when I did. So Everbank, my experience has been good. I can't give a really strong endorsement, but their service has been, I mean, I can give a good endorsement as far as my experience with them. They have a lot of products. They have a lot of, if you want CDs tied to gold, if you want CDs tied to silver, if you want CDs tied to a basket of currencies, they just got all kinds of products. And there may be an ETF in renminbi, but and I don't know which is the better way to go, but certainly Everbank has this sort of products. Paper money to me is, I don't think, any sort of safe refuge. So, I'm more of, trying to hide out in metal. And, it's interesting. I wrote a piece not too long ago. Doug Casey made the case for buying cigarettes or buying liquor and storing it. Anything that they would raise the price or raise the taxes on. And he thought it'd be an excellent idea to essentially buy, especially small quantity liquor. Like cases of pints and half pints that you could sell, and as the taxes on that went up, you'd be able to trade those. Things got bad. Cigarettes the same way. You can freeze them and keep them at least for a while. I know with the increase in taxes, I think recently in New York, what a pack of cigarettes I think is $10.50 or $11 or something like that up in New York. So if you're in a fairly they get truckloads of cigarettes hijacked all the time, and there's a case for even stocking up on things like that to protect yourself. And I had a case today with somebody talking to me about ammunition the ability to do reloads and things like that may hold up well in some sort of currency breakdown. So there's a lot of options out there if we do get a if we do get a dollar collapse, which we hope that doesn't happen, but certainly could. We've talked about John Law and what he did, keeping people out of gold, confiscating people's gold. You can see a situation where currency controls, you won't be able to move money overseas. I have friends from South Africa. They continually try to get money out of South Africa into the United States. There's only so much they can bring. They have this very clever suitcase devised where they can hide money and bring it over. And the same thing can happen with the United States. There are many people who consider it a good idea to get some gold offshore. Unless you have a friend or connections in other countries, I mean, that's problematic. Again, as things get ugly from a government point of view, anything can happen, and so protecting yourself is probably a good idea. It reminds me, I'm seeing the email I sent out. This is backtracking a little bit to the Vegas talk, but if you haven't had a chance, take a look at that CNBC interview with Phil Ruffin. Phil Ruffin is an interesting character. He's not some kind of high-flying Wall Street sharp guy. He's a guy who owned dog tracks in Wichita and had some casinos down in the Caribbean, and then he bought the Frontier once upon a time from Margaret Ilardi. He made a deal to, she got tired of fighting the culinary strike that had been going on for 6 years, and he bought the Frontier for, I don't know, a couple hundred million, and sold that land. Essentially, it was just land value for, I think, $1.3 billion, of course nothing's been built on that property. So he had a bunch of cash, spent $750 million of it buying the Treasure Island, buying it at a discount from MGM. He's asked frankly about how things are going in Vegas, and he said on Treasure Island property, it was doing $100 million. He said it's going to do $60 or $70 million this year. So that means essentially at that property, at least business is down 30% or 40% in Las Vegas. He said the condo market is essentially dead. He's partners with Donald Trump on the property in back of the land that he sold, and even though they've discounted the price in some cases 70%, they really can't sell the units. Nobody can get a loan. He described the Fountain Blue project, which is in Carl Icahn just bought out of bankruptcy, and as toxic with what it'll take to finish that property. He doesn't see how it'll ever cash flow. Very interesting interview, kind of a post. A lot of these guys, especially if they're publicly traded, if they have a publicly traded company, like a Steve Wynn or Sheldon Adelson, they spin the story in a fairly positive manner. Phil Ruffin owns his property for cash. He's the only owner. He's the only shareholder. He doesn't care, and is essentially telling it like it is. So it's a very interesting interview. When you look at him, you'll find it very interesting that he has a supermodel as a wife. They opened a world-class spa in the Treasure Island under her direction. So, anyway, looks are good for some things, but $1 billion makes you fairly attractive. So anyway, I urge you to take a look at the Phil Ruffin interview. So anyway, anyway, you guys are fairly active over there. I don't know if there's any further questions. We are closing now at 8 o'clock Central, which is my typical departure time. I do have someone waiting on me to take me to my birthday dinner. I have hit the ripe old age of 53 today. So anyway, if there are no questions, no further questions, I will proceed to doing that thing. But I just again want to say I want to thank all of you for participating in this and supporting the Mises Institute. I want to thank Grayson for really all he's done for me and this course and all he's doing for really this whole program. I think that we're really just taking the baby steps in this process, and you guys have allowed us to do that. Any technological breakdowns that we've had, you've been very forgiving and very supportive, and I just can't thank you guys enough. The technology is amazing. We're going to continue to push the envelope and do more and more of this. We have other organizations similar to ours looking at us with a little bit of envy. I'm pleased that we've been able to do this, and certainly Murray Rothbard would be proud if he were here to see this. Again, I want to thank all of you guys, and I'll create a test to the extent you guys want to take it. It'll be similar to the midterm, and it'll probably be 5 questions. Give me a day or two. We may not get it to you. I may not get it to you by the weekend. We've got I've got Mises University through the end of the week, but it's possible I may get around to it. But if it doesn't happen until next week, please forgive me. But you have an opportunity to answer some questions if you like. Remember last time I had made the comment that typically a minimum of 200 words would be needed. I know some people took that as a maximum of 200 words. No, it's not a maximum of 200 words to answer the question. Take as many words as you want, but typically the questions would need about 200 words to adequately answer them. In other words, you can't really handle it with a sentence or two to give me what I want. But I can't thank you guys enough and for your support of this and the Mises Institute. So with that, I am going to check out. Thank you for your wonderful birthday wishes, and be looking for the test, and check out our fall schedule, check out Gary North and whoever we might get in January. So with that, I bid you adieu. I'm going to check out. Thanks.